Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Welcome to the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes, bizarre occurrences, and get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories. To lighten things up, we'd like to end our time with a chaser. Please keep in mind some of our stories might be upsetting to young or sensitive ears.
We love hearing from our listeners, so feel free to contact us by email or social media. You can find our contact info in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to support us through Patreon, you can find us there at Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast, or use the link in our show notes.
Hey, podcast lovers. My name is Haley, and I run the Don't Identify podcast. I have been passionate about helping the unidentified get their names back ever since I found out I lived within miles of where Sherry Ann Jarvis, formerly known as the Walker County Jane Doe, was found. In my podcast, I tell the stories and provide information about unidentified people in hopes of reaching their loved ones and getting their names back. So come join me and help me advocate for these people. You never know, you could recognize someone's story.
Alrighty, Mom. What story are you going to be telling us about today?
Well, I'm going to be telling you about a family, the Klaus family, Harold, who went by Dean, and his wife Tina, and they had a baby named Holly. It's kind of a mystery that took 40 years to get some answers about.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And it's fairly recently that, like in the last couple of years, that they got some answers for this family. So I'm looking forward to telling you that story. It's got some twists and turns and weird stuff that happens. But anyway, what are you going to be telling us about?
Talking about the Jersey Man-Eater.
Oh, I don't like that.
No, it's not a good story.
No, can't be with so, that.
It's both brutal and bizarre, but anyways, to go with it, okay. I've got the shark bite cocktail.
Ooh.
Shark bite. Ooh, ah.
Yeah.
So this cocktail is 2 cups of ice, or sorry, 2 cups of ice cubes, 1 fluid ounce of simple syrup, 3/4 ounce of spiced rum, 3/4 ounce of light rum, 1/2 ounce of blue curacao, 1/2 ounce of lime juice, 3 drops of grenadine, or as needed, which my drops turned into more of a pour.
Pour.
But, yeah. Let's give it a try. It is so sweet.
It is really, really sweet. I did not think it was going to be that sweet.
Yeah, that's pretty rough.
Well,
it doesn't
taste
bad.
See...
It's just so sweet.
Oh, I did drops of grenadine for mine because I have like a squeeze bottle kind of grenadine.
It's
hard to do if you have a bottle, but it's still really sweet. And I like sweet drinks, but I don't think I like this one. I'll sit over here and sample it and see.
Yeah, maybe it'll grow on us.
Right. Eventually.
So let's talk about the Jersey Man-Eater.
Oof. Doesn't sound good.
It's really not good. So on July 1st, 1916, Charles Van Sant was on vacation in New Jersey with his family. Before going out for dinner, Charles wanted to take a quick dip in the ocean. Charles left his family in the room at the Ingleside Hotel and made his way to the beach. Calmly took off his shirt and sandals and waded into the water. He was an avid swimmer, so he made a good distance out from the beach when bystanders noticed him yelling and waving his arms. Most people thought he was trying to keep a stray dog from messing with his belongings left on the beach. However, a shark was actually eating Charles' leg.
No!
Yes.
No!
Yeah.
Oh, and it doesn't Lord. Stop there. Of course it
After
doesn't.
Lifeguard. Also, that's the shark bite drink.
Fit right, the name of the drink. Aptly chosen.
After lifeguard Alexander Ott noticed Charles flailing, he immediately swam out to help him. Alexander pulled him on shore and immediately noticed his left thigh was stripped of flesh. Yeah, just bone.
That is so gross.
Bystanders said that as Charles was being pulled out of the water, they could see the shark following them until they hit the beach. So they could see the fin chasing after the lifeguard and Charles. Yeah.
That is terrifying.
Charles was immediately brought to the hotel where he bled out on the manager's desk, which that seems like better places to go if you got a shark bite, but whatever. Maybe he wanted to see his family before he died.
Maybe.
Several captains reported multiple huge sharks near the coastline of Jersey while they were docking in Newark and New York. Only 5 days later, Charles Bruder walked from the Essex and Sussex Hotel to the nearest beach, which was about 45 miles north up the Jersey shore from the previous attack. So it wasn't like it was in the same town or anything. It was a little bit further away.
Farther. Okay.
He put down a towel and popped up a small lawn chair. After a while of soaking up the sun, he decided to cool off by taking a swim. He hopped in the water and began paddling. A woman enjoying her day on the beach was concerned when she heard screams coming from about 130 yards out. She stood up and spotted something red floating in the water. She immediately ran to the closest lifeguard tower and told them it appeared a red-bottomed canoe had flipped over and capsized. The lifeguards grabbed a small boat nearby and paddled out to what the lady saw.
I'm going to guess that it's not a canoe.
It wasn't a canoe. When they approached, the screaming got louder, and there they saw Charles Bruder, who had been attacked by a shark. The shark bit Bruder's abdomen in several times, which had severed his legs.
Oh.
Yeah.
He bit him in half?
Bit him in half.
Bit him in half.
Tried to be a pretty good-sized shark to bite him in half.
Was he still alive at that point, or did they just find his upper half?
He's
still alive? How?
The two lifeguards, Chris Anderson and George White, pulled Bruder out of the water, but sadly he bled out before they could get to shore.
Well,
so yeah, he died real quick after he got bit.
I can't believe he was still alive when they got to him.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive to be able to just like float there, not... Probably in a state of shock. Can't really do much.
No. And he's certainly not kicking.
Yeah. Two deadly shark attacks within a week of each other was fairly unusual for Jersey and sent the coastline into a state of panic. Only a few days after the Charles Bruder attack, Captain Thomas Cottrell was walking near a creek in the town of Matawan. He looked down and nearly shit himself when he saw an 8-foot-long shark swimming in the creek, which is about 3 miles off the coast.
Not in the ocean.
Not in the ocean.
Not.
He was walking on land, looked down into a creek, and saw an 8-foot shark.
Yeah, I could see shitting yourself, for sure.
Yeah. He ran into town and let everyone know. However, not many people took him serious.
No.
But not many people
know. Who would take him serious?
Not many people know that bull sharks, one of the most aggressive sharks, can actually survive in fresh water.
Great.
So,
great.
Yeah, in case you weren't scared of sharks, and you live not on the ocean, you should be scared.
Yeah, okay. Well, now I am. Thanks. Not going to be sleeping tonight.
On July 12th, only 6 days after the Bruder attack, 11-year-old Lester Stillwell was swimming with a couple of kids at Wyckoff Dock which is on, it's connected to that, the creek where the captain saw the shark.
Okay.
But just like, I think it's a mile or so down the, yeah, still not in the ocean.
Still not on the ocean though?
Nope.
Seriously?
Nope.
Oh my God.
The kids noticed a large black mass in the water, and as they went to investigate, a large dorsal fin popped out of the water and made a beeline for the group of kids. Before Lester could get out of the creek, he was pulled under by the shark. In a panic, the rest of the kids ran for help. No one believed that a shark got Lester, so several people went to investigate, including a businessman named Watson Fisher. Watson dove in to try and find Lester's body because he believed he had a seizure and fell under the water.
Okay.
When he found Lester's body, it was mangled. He grabbed onto it, but as he started swimming, the shark grabbed his leg and he dropped Lester's body. This time, a bunch of people had come to help look for Lester's body, so everyone saw Watson get nabbed by the shark. So there was no question what was killing these people.
My God.
He was transported to Monmouth Memorial Hospital, where he also bled out. Stillwell's body was recovered 150 feet upstream from the Wyckoff dock on July 14th, 2 days after the attack.
Oh my God.
The fifth and final victim, Joseph Dunn, he's 14 and he was in New York City. He was attacked a half a mile from the Wyckoff dock, nearly 30 minutes after the fatal attacks on Stillwell and Fisher.
That was Joseph a hungry was shark.
Swimming when the, yeah, he's got a taste for humans now.
No kidding.
Joseph was swimming when the shark grabbed his left leg. He said he could feel it going down the shark's throat. But Joseph's brother and friend saw him get grabbed by the shark, and they grabbed whatever they could of him and physically pulled him out of the shark's mouth. So scary.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
This is
Dunn was taken so to terrifying. St. Peter's University. Yeah, so he was taken to St. Peter's University Hospital in New Brunswick. He recovered from the bite and was released on September 15th, 1916. July 14th, a Harlem taxidermist and Barnum & Bailey's lion tamer, Michael Schleicher, was fishing when he caught a 7.5-foot, 325-pound shark while fishing in the Raritan Bay, which is connected to the creek that the shark was seen in. Like, the bay is where that river shoots out at, which is where the shark was caught.
All right, I need to pause for a second. Tell me the credentials of the guy that caught the shark.
Harlem taxidermist and Barnum & Bailey lion tamer. Turns out today he's a Barnum & Bailey shark tamer.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I'm dying. That's so funny.
The shark put up a crazy fight and almost sunk the boat, but Michael was able to stab it with a broken oar and kill it. So he got it up close enough and stabbed it with a broken oar.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Scientists determined it was a great white shark, and when they opened it up, they said it had human remains inside. No further attacks were reported along the Jersey Shore in the summer of 1916. After the capture of Michael's great white shark, Murphy and Lucas declared the great white to be the Jersey man eater.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Okay, but wait
a second.
The story
of the Jersey man eater.
Okay, so you said that the one guy saw it in a creek and it's believed that it was a bull shark. A bull shark's not the same as a great white shark, is it? They're different.
No, and great whites cannot survive in a creek. So I'm thinking that there was the great white that attacked the people in, a gang of sharks, different species going after humans.
They're all sitting around like, you can do the creek thing there, bull guy. So you can swim up the creek and look for lunch. We got to stay in the saltwater nonsense. So we'll just sit out here and snack on anybody who swims by.
Yeah. And there was like conspiracy theorists that said, so I guess like they thought a pod of sharks were following German U-boats because there would be a bunch of like carnage from the German U-boats. And so they thought these sharks got a taste for human flesh and then followed the German U-boats to the Jersey Shore and started eating people there. But
that's, oh, good Lord.
That's pretty dumb.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is wild.
Yeah. That's one of the inspirations for Jaws. That whole, because all five of those attacks happened within a, I think it was like 12 or 14 day period.
That is horrifying.
I would not be in the water if there was three shark attacks near me. I'm like, I will stay firmly on land.
Okay, but you expect a shark attack in the ocean. I mean, you go in the ocean thinking this is where shark attacks happen. If you're off a dock in a creek, you're not thinking that a shark is going to bite you and eat you and rip you in half. I would never think that.
I'm still not touching any water until that shark is dead or the attacks stop happening.
I mean, true, but... And you also, it makes me wonder who the human remains were that they found inside. I mean, back then they couldn't have tested it, but now they could go. Like,
clearly, it had to be one of them.
Yeah,
like, one of the ones in the ocean. It might not have been the one from the creek, but yeah, it's super weird.
How fast do sharks digest their food? I don't know.
It's a good question. Google will tell me.
That's a terrifying thought. Like, maybe it was all victims that nobody knew about, and some poor person was just out swimming by themselves.
To completely empty the digestive tract requires an astonishing 68 to 82 hours. So.
Okay.
Could be. I don't know. That's creepy.
I don't remember the timeline that you mentioned, but it's terrifying either way. I don't want to get eaten by a shark. So.
That breaks.
Yeah.
All right. Let's hear about
and
your
this story. This story probably was difficult for you to research because you hate going in the ocean.
I hate sharks too. That's why I'm scared of the ocean. Sharks and squids.
Yeah. You have hated the ocean since you were 2 years old.
Nothing good down there. Nothing good. Except for delicious fish, but.
Well, there's that. You can do
catch
like
those from on top of the water.
Yeah, that is a good point. You don't have to get in it and get eaten.
No.
All right, so I'm going to tell you my mystery, my 40-year-long mystery story that is also brutal and kind of bizarre. So Harold Dean Klaus Jr. was born June 7th, 1959, and he went by the name Dean. He had a brother and three sisters. His family described him as a very kind person. Tina Lynn was born September 21st, 1963. She had one brother and one sister. She was described as a sweet and happy person. Dean and Tina lived with their families in New Smyrna Beach, Florida. They met in 1979 when Dean was 19 and Tina was 15. Now, that seems a little young to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, when he's 19 and she's 15, but... They met because Tina's brother was dating one of Dean's sisters. So the families were close to each other. That's how they met. So it's not like Dean was out prowling around for 15-year-old girls, but they met, they fell in love. Both of the couples from the two different families ended up getting married. Dean and Tina were married in June 1979. When Dean was 20 and Tina was still 15. So she was going to be 16 soon, just a few months before she turned 16. Way earlier, in my opinion, than anybody should ever be considering getting married.
Really?
Regardless, they got married. Shortly after getting married, they had a baby on January 24th, 1980, and they named her Holly. Both families said that the young parents were supremely devoted to their new daughter. Dean worked in the construction business as a cabinet maker and was eager to earn a living for his growing family. So when he was given an opportunity to move to Texas and work for a large construction company, the family moved. In the summer of 1980, they settled in Lewisville, Texas, a suburb of Dallas, where they lived with Dean's cousin for a while. At the time that the Klaus family settled in Texas, there was a religious group that was also moving around in the area. And when I say religious group, you know I mean cult, because it's obvious, you know.
Yeah.
I have lost track of how many cult stories we've done, but they keep turning up. Even when I don't know a story is a cult story, I find out it ends up being a cult story. And there is a cult involved in this. And of course, cult stories generally don't turn out good.
No.
No. So, I promise, I did not know that there was a cult involved in this when I started researching it. This cult went by the name the Christ Family. Of course, there was a leader of the cult that the followers thought to be the second coming of Christ. There's always a cult leader, and everybody thinks he's the second coming of Christ, which makes me wonder if each cult has the second coming of Christ as their leader, why are there so many cults? Are there that many second comings of Christ?
Like, this guy's actually God. No, my guy's God.
Right. A cult war. That would be funny.
Yeah.
So this cult leader was named Charles Franklin Hughes. But of course, he didn't go by that. There's no evidence that he was directly involved with the story that I'm going to tell you, but I mention him because he was the leader and because he went by one of the most ridiculous names that I have ever heard. His followers called him, are you ready for this? Lightning Amen.
I was really hoping you're going to say McQueen after that.
Oh, nope. Just Lightning Amen. Yep, it's a Cars cult.
I would join that. I like that movie.
That's true. There's not a ton of information known about this cult, but it appears to have started in the 1960s and operated a lot in the southern part of the U.S. They were nomadic in nature and known for wearing white robes and no shoes. Children were discouraged in the group, possibly because the founder realized that having children around would prevent them from moving on quickly. I mean, if you've got a bunch of little kids, it's hard to just...
What?
Like, they would just move from place to place.
Whoa. Oh, yeah, I see.
When they're doing shady shit and they gotta get out of town real
Skip
quick,
town.
It's hard to do when you got a bunch of little kids running around. So if people had kids, they were like, yeah. We can't have that. So members of the cults who did have children, if you had children and then you joined the cult, they would tell you to get rid of your kid. And usually the family would give them away to another family member or someone that they knew to raise the child. Mm-mm. So you join a cult and you're like, we don't like kids. And then you just go to your neighbor and go, hey, here's my kid. Peace out.
He's yours now.
I don't know. It's weird. Anyway, that's a little bit about the cult. Now we're going back to the Klaus family. Having moved away from their families in Florida, Dean and Tina would stay in touch with family through mail. Because again, this is a while ago. It's before emails, before cell phones, before all of that. And long distance calling back in the day was very expensive. So they would send letters and pictures through snail mail. And they did so until the end of 1980, a few months after moving to Texas. Suddenly the letters just stopped. Families didn't know what was going on. They just didn't get any more letters. The first clue came in the spring of the following year when Dean's mom, Donna, was contacted by a man wanting to return Dean's car. He wanted to meet her at the Daytona racetrack in the middle of the night and give her the car back. Why he chose a racetrack in the middle of the night, I don't know. I don't know that there's any answer about this. They don't even really know who this guy was. Why That's he weird. Wanted to give the car back, I also don't know. This whole, like, return the car part was super bizarre. I mean, if you found a car, why would you give it back? You're like, oh, okay, whatever. I don't know. Back in 1980 and 81, maybe there was a big...
It doesn't want it anymore?
Maybe. I don't know. So the man claimed that he was a detective in L.A. and that the vehicle was found abandoned. Which, okay, if that were the case, I can understand, like, an L.A. officer calling and saying, you need to get the car back. But the rest of this returned car thing is so sketchy. Donna asked about Dean's whereabouts, but the man claimed to know nothing about him. He just said, we found the car and you need the car back. We're going to get you the car back. But I need $1,000 from you to return the vehicle for my expenses. So give me $1,000.
Buy your car and, back.
Right. She agreed to this. Dean's mom agreed to this, but she felt uneasy about the situation. Donna went to the racetrack and was met by three women in Dean's car. Not a man, but three women. All of the women were wearing white religious-looking robes and no shoes. So back to the basic description of these cult members. One of the women appeared to be in her late 20s or early 30s and went by the name Sister Susan. The other two women were younger, possibly in their teens or early 20s. Sister Susan informed Donna that Dean and Tina had joined their group and in doing so had given up all of their possessions and all contact with their families. Apparently, Dean had a history of making acquaintances with different cults and had even followed a cult or two when he was a teenager. So for him to be involved with a cult, his family was not super surprised. They were like, he's done it before, followed a cult around, okay. Not unheard of in their family, and they weren't necessarily surprised by that discovery. Dean and Tina's family reported them missing, but because they were adults and it wasn't illegal to join a cult, there was nothing legal that could be done. So the families just went on with their lives, believing that young Klaus family had made a decision to live their lives separate from everyone that they had known before. They hoped that Dean, Tina, and baby Holly were happy and healthy wherever they were. Until Dean's sister, Debbie, got a surprising phone call in 2021. Dean and Tina had been found. They were found 40 years earlier in 1981, though. Unfortunately, they were far from happy or healthy, and it took 40 years to determine their identities. You see, Dean and Tina had been found deceased in a thickly wooded and swampy area outside of Houston in January of 1981. So this is a few months after their letters stopped coming.
Okay, the so letters it took them 40 years to identify the bodies?
Yes. They had zero clue who these people were because the family filed a missing persons report from the family's in Florida. They were last known to be in Lewisville, Texas, which is hours away from Houston. And the bodies were found in Houston, outside of Houston. So back in the 80s, no identification. They had no way to know who these people were, but we'll get to that. The discovery of their bodies was pretty gruesome and occurred when a dog who had been let out to run through the woods came back carrying part of a human arm.
Oh, that's so gross.
Could you imagine your dog is out playing in the woods and he comes back and you're like, what you got in your mouth, boy?
So gross.
And they drop, your little old doggy drops an arm. I would be forever freaked out. I would never let my dog off leash again. It was estimated that that both victims had died several days to weeks before the discovery. The only thing found with the bodies was a pair of green shorts and a bloody towel. There was no ID, and the conditions of the bodies didn't allow for a decent picture for identification purposes. Although sketches were completed and circulated of what a forensics artist thought the people might have looked like when alive, no one came forward to identify them. Because again, their family is in Florida. The bodies were found.
Not sharing that right. type of stuff like over worldwide news.
No. They're like, oh, hey, people in Houston, look out for these pictures because you might know them, when no one in Houston knew them.
Yeah.
The bodies were found just a few feet from each other. An autopsy showed the female died from strangulation and the male had been bound and beaten. Some believe the male was killed as he was trying to protect the female. Since no one came forward to claim the deceased couple, they were labeled as Harris County Does and buried in a community plot with minimal grave markings. Some people also referred to them as Romeo and Juliet because they thought that he was trying to protect her. In 2011, with some financial assistance from different sources, the couple's remains were exhumed to gather DNA. It took 10 years to find the family link of Dean's sister and finally give names to the Harris County Does. The genealogists were excited to bring some closure to the family mystery, but they didn't know that they weren't finished because they didn't know that there was also a missing baby, Holly Marie.
Shit.
So the genealogists are super excited. They're like, cool, we finally have identities for these bodies from 40 years ago. Now we have names for them. And they go, oh, the sister, when they notify her, she's like, what about the baby? And they're like, what are you talking about, a baby?
Shit.
Yeah. Investigators didn't believe that Holly had died with her parents. There were no child remains found in the area. There was also no matching baby doe cases that would have matched Holly. So the search began to find her, starting in the last known location, which was Lewisville, Texas. Public appeals were made in an effort to find her. Several women who believed they might be Holly submitted their DNA, but none were a match. Detectives tried to get Holly's original birth certificate in Florida, but they learned that the records were sealed because she'd been adopted. They were able to get the documents unsealed and finally learned what had happened to baby Holly. In November 1980, shortly after the last letter was sent by Tina Klaus, a preacher in Arizona, 1,300 miles away from where Dean and Tina's bodies would later be found, the preacher had a knock on the back door of his church. His name was Philip McGoldrick. Answering the door, he found three women dressed in white religious-looking robes, not wearing shoes, and holding a baby. The women told him that they were giving the baby away. "We're just going to give this baby away. Will you take her?" Oh, he's like, "You need a babysitter?" And they're like, "No, we're giving this baby away. We want to give her away to somebody. Will you take her?"
Jesus.
Yeah. So they explained that
her parents were in the cult then?
Well, questionable. But okay. It does. Because you said in the beginning like
that the cult members went and gave their kids away.
Yes. So, when the preacher asked, like, "Why are you giving this baby away?" the women were like, they explained they, you know, lived a nomadic lifestyle and therefore they couldn't take care of a baby. So they were just going to give the baby away and wanted to give them to somebody that they thought might take good care of the baby. And they thought a preacher could do that. So they knocked on his door. One of the women had a note stating that she was the mother and giving away her parental rights. It is possible this woman was actually Tina and was giving Holly away, but it's not known for sure because the date of Tina's death could not be determined, only estimated. So Tina's found in January of 1981, and this happened, the baby giveaway happened in November of 1980, so a couple months before. So it's possible that Tina signed her parental rights away on this note and gave the baby to this random stranger at a church. But there's zero way to verify that. Mm-hmm. There was another letter presumed to be written by Dean also requesting to give up his parental rights. Investigators were concerned that the adoptive parents, Philip and Constance McGoldrick, might know something to be, you know, or have somehow been involved in Tina and Dean's murders, but there was no evidence to that. And they soon learned how the McGoldricks came to meet baby Holly when she was almost a year old. So she wasn't even a year old and they gave her away or something happened to them. I mean, it's possible that because they estimated it was weeks to months before they were found, it's possible that Dean and Tina were killed before Holly was given away and that's why she was given away, or it's possible that they were part of the cult and they willingly gave her away to this random stranger.
Yeah, that's weird. It's not a formal adoption process. It sounds like they just wrote it on like a napkin.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, it ended up being a formal adoption. That's why her birth certificate was sealed in Florida. Okay. But, I mean, the McGoldricks did officially adopt her, but who knows what happened on the timeline. So, Holly was finally contacted by detectives on June 7th, 2022, the anniversary of her father, Dean's birthday. Holly was 42 years old, married, and was a mother of five living in Oklahoma. She had no idea what had happened to her birth parents and that they had been murdered. Holly was able to meet her birth family over a Zoom call the same day she met with those investigators. So they come rolling up on her work and they're like, "Hey, by the way, your parents were killed and you're a missing child, and do you want to meet your birth grandma and aunts and uncles over a Zoom call?"
Jesus.
It's so strange.
But so weird.
Yeah. In that call, she learned how much her birth family loved and missed her. She heard that they had been looking for her for decades. She met them in person 5 months later, and she was able to see the baby book that Tina had made for her when Holly was born. Holly has written a book about her life called Finding Baby Holly, Lost to a Cult, Surviving My Parents' Murders, and Saved by a Prayer. Holly believes that her parents were having second thoughts about being with the Christ family cult and were trying to leave it, and that was why they were murdered. Unfortunately, there is no proof of any of that. That's just her gut instinct. The investigation into Dean and Tina's murders is still ongoing because they have no idea who did it.
Super
so
weird.
So the murder...
Did you say how old Holly was when she met her family?
42 years old.
That's what I was thinking, because they were found murdered in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So
she was 42.
That's crazy.
It is very crazy. But it's another one of those genealogy, DNA saves the day kind of things. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Do you have a chaser for us today?
Just watched this movie the other day called Sisu, S-I-S-U, and it's so good. I watched it because I rented it on Amazon, and you can watch it for like 48 hours or something, so I watched it twice, like back to back within the same day.
Wow.
But it's like World War II John Wick, almost. Like, this old retired Finnish spec ops guy becomes, like, he finds millions and millions of dollars worth of gold on his property. And so he's going into town, but it's in the end of World War II, so the Nazis are just kind of, like, being as bad as they could before they all got killed. So this guy goes into town, and the Nazis stop him and try and take his gold, and he does some pretty cool stuff. Yeah. It's very unrealistic, but it's a fun movie.
Okay. That's cool.
Yeah.
I'll have to check that out.
What's your chaser?
My chaser is that we are in 54 countries being downloaded.
Ooh, wow.
54 different countries are listening to us. And do you have a guess outside of the U.S. which country has listened to us the most?
I'm going to say like Finland or something.
Ooh, no. It's France.
Really?
France has downloaded us more, not as much as the U.S., but they're second. And then second, third, and fourth are pretty close. Yeah, exactly. Bonjour. Merci. So I don't know how to say downloads in French. I should have looked that up, but
understand us if they're listening, if downloading.
Valid point. I was just trying to be polite. So, I thought that was pretty cool. It's fun to run the analytics every once in a while and see that.
Yeah. It's like, how did you find us? Let us know if you're living in France. How did you find us?
Yeah, no kidding. Something. Right. Please do.
Well, I enjoyed hearing that super bizarre story. Yours was more bizarre than mine. Mine was pretty brutal.
I know. We kind of both did brutal and bizarre all rolled into one. Which we don't often end up doing. So,
that's
pretty cool. Good stories, though.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Love you, Mom.
Yes. Thank you. Love you too, bud. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, friends. Thank you for supporting our podcast. Please share our show with your brutal and bizarre friends. Give us a boozy follow on your favorite podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating or review as well. But maybe do that sober so all the letters are in the right place.
You can find all our contact information in the show notes. We love hearing from you, and if you're interested in helping us stock the bar for our future boozy episodes, you can find our Patreon link in the show notes as well.